What's up, everybody? It's Mr. James O'Neill here, keynote speaker and owner of Mastery for All, where we partner with school districts across the country to ensure that all are mastering mathematics by highlighting the brilliance of our Black boys, because if we can get them, we have all. Our motto here is Mastery for All, empowered by Equity for All through the belief of expectations for who? For all, y'all. And if I'm saying y'all, you already know where I'm hailing from, the South, by way of the Queen City, Charlotte, North Carolina. And I am super excited that you decided to join me. So welcome to season 3 of the Mastery for All podcast with myself. I'm excited because in this season, I'm coming hot and heavy with this question. Is math a racist subject? Now, I know some of you all are wondering about the title, so let me give you a little bit of background. A while ago, I was on LinkedIn and I saw an article asking the question, is math a racist subject? After reading that article, I was inspired to bring this subject to the space of my podcast and wanted to answer the same question with the brilliant minds I have met in the math education space dedicated to the mission of Mastery for All. How can we teach math more equitably? How can we give access to all of our students? These are the questions we're going to be asking in that question. So I want you to be open to the things that these brilliant minds have to say, these colleagues of mine. So is math a racist subject? Well, let's find out. I'll see you on the other side of this question. Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of Mastery for All with Mr. James O'Neill. Y'all know I am doing this series on Is Math a Racist Subject? And today I have joining me Miss Adrienne Batops Paul. Can we give it up for her? Hey, Adrienne.
Hello, James. Thanks for having me.
Yes, ma'am. It's good to see you. Good to be with you and good for you to be here. And I'm glad that you actually said yes to coming on the podcast today. So y'all know that I don't just bring anybody up on this podcast. Like, it's going to be people that are legit and people that have been out here in what we call the math streets doing the work. So I'm just going to hop right on into it and give you all Adrienne's bio, just a snapshot of it. Adrienne Batops Paul has been an educator for over 10, goodness, I said 10, it's been 2 decades.
That's major math right there.
She's been around for a long time, y'all. She's heavenly sent. She really is heavenly sent. For 2 decades, and has always sought to provide children with informative, engaging and effective learning experiences. With Unbound Ed, she creates mathematics professional development, also known as PD, content, and trains math educators to facilitate summits and institute sessions. Adrienne is the chief operating officer of My Mathematical Mind, a mathematics education consulting firm through which she conducts PD for math educators and administrators around the country. Adrienne began her career as a language arts teacher, then shifted her focus to learning more about mathematics pedagogy. She has taught math on both the elementary and middle school levels. As a 7th grade math teacher, she worked to detract pre-algebra to provide high quality and equitable mathematics learning opportunities for all of her students. She regularly writes about mathematics instruction standards and best practices and has had her research published in the Journal of Mathematics and Science. Adrienne holds an English degree, holds English degrees from University of Chicago and Columbia University, and a master's degree in K-8 mathematics education leadership from George Mason University. And so y'all already know she's brilliant. She's amazing. And I'm bringing her on. So can we give it up for Adrienne Batops Paul?
Hello, hello, and hello.
Hey, hey, Adrienne. I'm glad that you're here. Reading your bio beforehand, I was just like, oh, I knew you started off in ELA. We had that conversation beforehand. Yes. And then I was looking and I was just like, okay, chief operating officer of My Mathematical Mind. I see you. And so we're going to get into your journey and everything and just lift up what you do in this space of mathematics education. And before we go into that, I always start the podcast with the leading question, which is the topic of the podcast itself. Is math a racist subject? What is your thoughts around that question?
Thank you so much for having me again, James. And my response to that would be, I don't currently feel that math is a racist subject. I think those who have had a deep command of the subject for decades, for many, many years, have prevented others from engaging with the subject in a way that could change their lives. And I think they've done that because of that very reason, right? So while I don't think the subject itself is inherently racist, particularly because if I'm not mistaken, I believe it has its roots with people of color anyway. I don't think that currently people of color have been given access to mathematics in the way that would provide fruitful lives for us. I think those who have that deep command that I mentioned have used their attitudes and their actions to restrict that access because of their, like I said, because of their biases. Belief that math was or should be restricted to the elite as an intellectual luxury. That ideal is perpetuated by people, not by the subject itself. So that's another reason why I don't think that math itself is necessarily racist.
Woo, you just dropped a word that, Adrian, I'm going to have to give you props on, because that phrase is probably going to never leave my life. Intellectual luxury.
Oh, well, let me clarify. That is from a New York Post article that I just read recently. So it's okay. My words, but which is why I did this. But that's essentially how the math as a subject has been carried and manipulated in this Western culture, and which is why it has been it's now a subject that causes such anxiety and such trauma and discomfort. Because it was for so long something that seemed unattainable or unreachable or untouchable. So that when I actually read that phrase last week, I was like, oh, yes, that's exactly that's exactly how math has been, how it's been handled.
I that phrase is powerful. It is. And I love words, you know. Yes. People will be like, you're a math teacher and you love words. Because I love poetry and I do spoken word from time to time. I haven't written anything in years. But still, when I hear words, because I'm a creative as well. And so when I hear that, it just paints the picture, the perfect picture. And just to lead into your bio, when I heard you say intellectual luxury, I thought about your fact that you detract pre-algebra. Can you talk about that and the relation to that as it relates to this intellectual luxury of mathematics?
Sure. When I was asked to do that, it was at a very prominent boys independent school. And it was steeped in its traditions. So that meant that the separation of generalists and honor students was pervasive, and it was just a part of the thread of the culture of the school. So when we were asked to do it, I could see how it could occur, but we worked really hard to ensure that the equity piece was front and center in every decision that we made, from the type of task to the numbers in the tasks, to how we were going to either provide practice for students or provide extensions for students in real time in the same lesson, in the same experience. And my chancing upon the text Building Thinking Classrooms by Peter Liljedahl allowed us, or gave us, additional steps to detract pre-algebra in a way that made sense for us and in ways that we could explain to the boys in terms of what they were experiencing and why all of a sudden this shift had occurred in their seventh grade year versus the year before or ever before at their school. So in detracking, this meant that we had students of all levels of exposure to mathematics. And I like to try to think about students' engagement with mathematics as exposure to versus those who are stronger or less
others. Yeah.
Because a lot of times that's exactly what it is. And that's what we saw with our 65 boys. It wasn't that some of the students who would have been in the general class were unable to understand math at a high level. It's just they had never been exposed to it. And those who did or had that more procedural-based understanding of mathematics worked to develop their conceptual understanding of math. So all of a sudden, that one way, that one algorithm that they were married to became one of a few strategies or one of a few ways for them to approach a task. And it leveled the playing field socially in the room as well, because, of course, when you have a general level and you have that higher level, the boys or the students at the general level look up at the boys or students in the honors level as students having something that they don't have.
Right.
Being better than they are for whatever reason. In this case, through our intentional planning around mathematical discourse, again, providing exposure to the students and helping them see that there are multiple ways to think about mathematics and having them listen to each other and learn and grow their own thinking as a result of not just listening to us, but listening to one another. That social hierarchy dissipated.
Wow.
And so we were, through our intentional planning of every aspect of the students' experience, we were able to see boys who were strong and thought they were more than and didn't see the need to engage with students who didn't have that same level of exposure do that very thing. And those boys who didn't see themselves as mathers at all become that over that period of time, over the course of the year. And again, they went from being students who didn't believe in themselves to students who saw themselves as mathers and were became risk takers. Gotcha. And you have to be that way in any class, but especially in a math class, right? And I and the teacher that I taught with, Jody Munier, we made it a point to help the boys understand that we were also taking a risk in facilitating learning in the way we decided to do it, to help them see that we were pretty good role models to look to if they were wondering about developing confidence in an area that was unfamiliar territory.
That's first of all, you said a lot in that, and my mind and my everything was spinning because I heard that the tracking, what it did, it created equity, because many times in education, we throw that word out and we just equity, everything is equitable. But in that space, equity looks like we are all getting access. And it is not that is what we call our gatekeeping. We're not going to gatekeep the intelligence of who can and who can't because of what we give access to. We're going to give access to all and build in those supports to make sure that those that are now getting this exposure are not overwhelmed. Because when I remember literally skipping from the seventh grade math, I was in eighth grade math class and a teacher pulled me out and was just like, hey, we want you to take this placement test and get into Algebra 1. And at that time, I'm thankful that I had enough success in math that exposure was just like, oh, what are we doing? Like the students had pre-algebra, the gifted kids had pre-algebra the year before. So it was just like, this is a brand new world for me. But because I felt honored to be invited, that whole piece about like, looking at kids and feeling like they have something that you don't have. I literally sat in classrooms and saw my white peers leave the classroom and go do their gifted stuff. And I was like, they clearly have something that I don't have. And that internalized, and I'm going to shut up in a moment because you just triggered me. But that internal, you start to internalize that, that's where internalized racism comes from. You don't know it, but you are literally breathing in what we call the smog, this smog of racism. Mm-hmm. You just breathing that thing in and you don't know it until you show up and just be like, oh, I don't think I have it because of these social norms. And so you use a term called Mathers, and I want you to explain that term just in case my listeners are like, what's a Mather? What is a Mather?
A Mather is a person who uses math to make sense of the world. So a better question would be, who isn't a Mather?
Come on. Right?
It's an inclusive term that was coined by Deborah Parrott, my CEO at My Mathematical Mind. And she wanted to find a term that was inclusive, that had positive connotations around mathematics, and that went along with our cultural thinking about reading and writing. Readers read, writers write. Why can't Mathers math?
Love it. I love it. So if you're hearing it for the first time, shout out to Deborah. Clearly, I was just with her yesterday in Newark. And we were talking about that before we got on. And so we all are Mathers. That is what we are. If we are, we can be readers, we can be Mathers. Readers read, Mathers do math. And we use that math to make sense of the world. We're all Mathers. We can't get away from it. We are all Mathers. So I'm excited because the conversation is already good because you're already dropping some amazing things. And I appreciate the work that you did with the whole detracking because, and I'm just going to ask, I'm going to stay there for a little bit longer. So some people feel like there's no issue with tracking. Like we should create tracks that everybody's not supposed to go to the same place. They should have options, if you will. What are the pros, the cons of tracking, or is there just cons to it? What is your take on that?
I think I kind of spoke to what some of the cons are, right? That perception that students have of other students that they that causes them to feel like they are less than, as well as the antithesis of that, right? The feelings that those who are in those honors tracks feel that they are better than for whatever reason, and the pressure that comes along with maintaining that honors track, right? So there's some cons to that as well. I would say, though, that there are pros to having choice, and I think that speaks to student agency. Mm-hmm. And I think based on the importance of students having the basic foundations of mathematical concepts, if not mastered, at least being able to think flexibly about number between K and 8. By 9th, maybe 10th grade, I think students or children rather are could potentially be mature enough to start to make choices about what type of math they want to pursue. I believe that it should be a pursuit up and through senior year. But I think our schools need to shift what math looks like in 10th, 11th and 12th grades. Mm. I think there should be more business classes reinstituted into high schools. I think there should be courses on the stock market, and you could have a course on the stock market in 10th, 11th and 12th grades. So you can start to think about how to apply all of this math that you learned for all the years prior.
So
when you graduate, you can think about how to use that math to help you make a change in the world, improve your situation, improve your community, improve our nation. I think that is supposed to be the point of school in the first place, right? So I can pretty much say that I prefer tracking to not occur through kindergarten or kindergarten through eighth grade, and certainly not, and maybe not in ninth. 10th, 11th, and 12th graders, I think, are mature enough, or at least should be given the options to think about how they want to be able to utilize math in those grade levels and beyond high school.
Got you. Wow, that's different and unique and special. I really love your approach as to what math can look like and real world applicable math as it relates. Like, you've been in these classes. Now let's see, as you grow up and you mature, like, you need, this is the math that you're going to really engage in, with majority of us will engage in our real world. And some of the stuff that you said, like stock market, like, that's again, gatekeepers, like, who gets access to that level of information. And even with credit cards, like, in my business, I've learned, like, there is a business way that people talk about money that the normal consumer don't hear about. And the only reason why I know this is because I now have access to people that literally have money. So again, if I'm raised in those homes, then I'm going to normally hear these conversations if my parents may be privy of it, but I'm going to be in an environment where these things are happening. So I love this. You know, we got away from my initial question because the whole detracting thing got to me. And I was just like, I need to dive into that, because that intellectual luxury, that thing just took me out for a minute. So
I want to add something to that.
Yeah, before I move back. Go ahead, add.
Another, in terms of students having choice, and you made me think about this also, having access to personal finance classes would be so valuable in your 10th or 11th or 12th grade experience. So that, again, is another way to think about helping students understand, like, there is a reason why you need to understand fractions. There's a reason why you need to understand percents, because you're going to utilize this maybe subconsciously as an adult, but you will use these skills in your life later on. And if you really play your cards right, you can utilize these skills to help live a lucrative life.
Yeah.
And break down the gate that you keep referencing.
I love it. I love you coming in with that, because it made me think really about, like you're saying, like, who has access to what, and this personal understanding of our world through mathematics. Mm-hmm. Like, it is powerful when you know where it shows up in your life. And how you can, you know, like you said, live a more lucrative life if you are aware of the decisions and the pitfalls that are out there when it comes to finances. I mean, just in general, like, it's going to be, once you get out your mom and daddy house and you start paying for stuff on your own, you be like, oh, this is a little different. You know, and I gotta, and so many of us are just thrown into that life. And literally, when you were talking, I thought, as I'm talking now, I thought about my first credit card in college. And I got it because they were giving out free pizza and a T-shirt. Right now on Hillsborough Street in NC State University. And I still got the T-shirt to this day. And but nobody set me down to talk about credit cards. And so literally, here's my life. Here's my life. And so I back to our original question.
Back to the pros. Okay. So, but I thought to mention the pro being one of choice, because parents think that having access to an honors track is a choice that they should be able to provide their children.
Yeah.
Right. And I would counter that by saying, something that I said in my Ignite for NCTM last year, if teachers can spend the time creating curricula for honors tracks, they can spend that same time creating curricula that is inclusive, that where you can have students of all levels of exposure to mathematics in the space. And I know that to be true because of the work we did with D-tracking. I'm not just kind of talking out of my neck here. I actually do know that that is a possibility. If your heart is in the right place, if you understand the need, you get to know your students through multiple modes of pre-assessments, and you devote yourself to that equity piece. You're constantly thinking, how can I provide nearly everyone what it is that they need? I don't think that that can happen if there's only explicit instruction taking place. So another pro to creating this space for all types of math students to coexist is access to inquiry-based learning or discovery-based learning, because out of that experience come so many character traits.
Yeah.
How to collaborate. You learn how to be an active listener. You learn how to debate. You learn how to question. You learn how to consider others' ideas. You learn how to agree with their ideas or disagree, not with the person, but with the idea. Right. So you are not only learning mathematical content, but you're learning life skills that you can take to your next class and out of school. So here we are now thinking about mathematics being this tool to develop our humanity. And that's what we saw as a result of the work that we were doing in this D-tracked space.
That
was something that one could only understand if they observed it. That was a very abstract piece of the experience that parents really did not get or understand until we did a couple of simulations where they came in and were our students and they experienced a part of a math lesson like their children did every day. It was after that, that the parents, the majority, not everyone, but the majority of the parents who were pushing back and really were requesting more explicit instruction and more traditional approaches began to see the validity behind what we were doing and why we were doing it. And I can't tell you how many emails we received after those simulations from parents stating, I wish I had learned math like this.
Wow.
I was nervous at first, but my partners made me feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Like all of those things, I kind of got chills,
but
all of those things. So again, another pro was having the ability to develop these character traits out of this math experience.
I love you're going to take us down a different road today, and I'm ready to travel with you, Adrian, to go back to even the first question I asked you about, is math a racist subject? I hear you in everything that you're saying. It's the anti-racist approach to mathematics. Access is what you said. Creating a space where everybody is growing. And one thing is that you said, using mathematics to develop our humanity. Woo, that's such a good old... Because even when we think about sometimes when students say, when I'm going to use this, and sometimes it's like, to be honest, they may never use that. But what you are gathering in the process of synthesizing your thoughts and the trial and error of finding, does this work and how does it work, and the sense making, like, that is priceless, because you're going to have to make sense of life. Like, you're going to go through changes, you're going to go through shifts, and you're going to have to look at the data of your life and problem solve. Literally is what I hear you saying, that mathematics developing our humanity. And when we advocate, right, the numbers is a person. There's no longer this number. This number is reflective to a person. And so I want to get to, we just on the first part, I just want to get to my second question to you, Adrian. And you're already, I feel good. You're already there. What you've been talking about your experience of making sure that all you're at a boys' school. And so specifically now, but what has also been your experience to make sure that all races master mathematics?
Well, that was I found to be the most challenging of your questions. And so I had to really think deeply about what have I done to do that specifically. I'm going to be honest and say that I have, whenever I've had the opportunity, I have worked from the inside out. And what that means is I've looked at my students of color and their needs first, and then worked to think about what everybody else would need.
Okay, let me ask you this. Why start there?
Because the majority of my professional teaching experience has been in independent schools. And so I made it a point as a Black woman who was oftentimes the only Black teacher in the particular building, yeah, or maybe one of three on campus. I wanted to ensure that my students of color knew I saw them.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be intentional about that. And so it doesn't mean I left anybody by the wayside, because
that's exactly what I want people to hear. They hear that. And mm-hmm. I say it all the time, and I'll let you get back to it. Mm-hmm. I want you to hear inclusivity, not exclusivity. When I lift up these individuals, whoever they are, it is because they have not had someone to lift them up.
Yes.
And so I want you to hear inclusivity.
Yes.
I'm excluding anybody. No, oh. I'm finally including the people that really need the help. All right, back to you, Adrian.
Yes. No. You're absolutely right. And to get to funnel it down just a little bit more, I would start with thinking about my boys, my Black boys. I did a lot of research around Black boys' education during my time at Columbia. And so I came out of, I think I was in my third year of teaching at that point. So I went back into my teaching environment, really thinking deeply about how to appeal to the few Black boys that I would come in contact with during the school year. So in terms of addressing all races, I would use pre-assessments to really get to know all of my students. I would, again, utilize that information that I learned about attending to my Black boys to think about how to plan my lessons. And then during the summers when I taught students who were from local public schools, that was when I had more of a diverse population of students in front of me.
Yeah.
And I would do the same thing. I would get, I would give them pre-assessments. I would ask them, for those who spoke more than one language, I would ask them to, you know, teach us something in their native tongue with regard to the math that we were working on at the time.
That's beautiful.
Oh yeah, I had to do that. Because language is access, right? So I wanted to help them see that what they were bringing into the classroom, their funds of knowledge were extremely valuable to me, if no one else. I was acutely aware, like you were saying before, that there may be, it may be that I would be the only teacher of color that these students would have. And so students of color, students of European descent, like actual Europe coming over, you know, those kinds of students and children in front of me, I wanted to help them see that what they were bringing to the class was valuable. And in utilizing pre-assessments, I was able to insert some of their interests into the work we were doing. One project that I did a few years ago, actually with my seventh grade boys, was a project called ELG, Everyday Learning Graphs. So in my efforts to help them understand the constant of proportionality and move into their understanding of slope, I had them use themselves as data points. So they selected two questions that they were going to study, and the questions were collected from the teachers on our hall and some questions I had. And they chose two questions that spoke to some aspect of their lives. And then they had to record the data over the course of, I think, about 8 days, and then plot it. And, you know all the math and everything behind it. Yes, but ma'am. It allowed students to bring some aspect of their lives into the space, and to help them see, look, you doing math every day when you wake up and your clock goes off at 7:05 and you don't get up till 7:20 because you already figured out how long it's going to take you to brush your teeth and comb your hair.
Right.
Before dinner or before breakfast, like you're doing these things. Or when you're thinking about your score on your video game from one day to the next and comparing it to your friends that you're talking to through that headset, like you all are talking and thinking about mathematics, even if you don't realize it. So I think one of the ways that I try to appeal to the multiple races of students that I taught was to give them an in and allow them to see that they were that in. They didn't have to be anything more than what they were. And that was enough.
That was enough. That is enough. It's different when you have an educator in front of you that feels to welcome everyone, that space, in that learning environment. I remember when I wanted to, when culturally responsive teaching really started talking, getting out there, I was just like, how can I lift this up in math? Because many times people's like, it's hard to do it. It's hard. And there is a challenge when it comes to math from time to time, but it is how you present, is what you give access to them. So I literally, in the story that you were talking about, when we got to system of equation, we were using them in Desmos, we were graphing lines that, you can actually name the point. And I just threw out one day, I was like, name the solution, your favorite food. And in that moment, because there's such a diversity of cultures, you hear food in their native tongue. And I'm just going around the room like, oh, tell me about, I remember something, and I was trying to pronounce it in Spanish, and all my Hispanic kids would laugh at me. It's like, that's not how you say it, Mr. O'Neill. I was like, y'all know I'm doing my best. Just tell me about the food. Where can I get it from? Right. What restaurant? And so in that moment, culture is lifted up. The math is not diminished. The things that, but they feel like, oh, you want to know about me, and I can bring who I am in this space. So I heard you talking about, your Black boys, and that is near and dear to my heart. As Mastery for All really supports the Mastery for All by lifting the mastery of our Black boys, because many times if you look at any other data points, who's at the bottom? That is a Black male student. And so what has been your thoughts concerning why historically Black boys do not do as well in mathematics? What are your thoughts, your experience, your ahas, anything as it relates to that question?
Sure. I think our boys are fighting an uphill battle, right? So the first thing that comes to mind is 2%.
Mm. That number has went down to 1.3 now.
1.3 or 1.7. Yeah. 1.3. Yeah. That is almost like the first, second, and tertiary reason why our boys are struggling. And it's,
and for the people that don't know what we're talking about when we say 2%, what do you mean by 2%?
2%, less than 2% of our teachers in this country are Black males. Mm-hmm. And so then of that 2%, even less are elementary.
Wow. Yeah.
Teachers, right? So that means that our boys are missing out on a role model relationship that could be, to be cliche, a game changer for them. I think there's another piece, and it's fear, because our Black boys are experience adultification before they're adults.
Ooh.
Our teachers are looking at our baby boys like they're men. So there's a level of subconscious fear showing up in there somewhere that's preventing our boys from being seen as children. And so this dastardly bias, right, damages our boys and strips them of the childhood graces that are afforded other kids.
Ooh, come on, come on. You're talking the talk.
So this is this less than 2% is why. Okay. Cause think about who is in the other part of that percentage. If it's less than 2% Black male, who is everybody else? Well, who is that other side of that percentage, right? And then another thought is, up until recently, because now it's almost like common practice because it's current and trendy, I think. Mm-hmm. Up until recently, our baby boys were not even seen as capable or worthy of math, right? So, and I say this because I, again, have over 20 years of looking at different textbooks. And I, you know, when I started to hone in on math textbooks, I had to wonder, where are the story problems about our little boys?
Yeah.
And their interests? Where are the pictures? Hmm? Where are the images? All you showing me is some Black fingers. Where is this boy's face?
Yeah. Come on.
Where is he? They were not included in traditional textbooks. So, hey, out of sight, out of mind. Their stories don't count, and neither do they. So on the flip side of that, if you are that little Black boy and you're witnessing this and you are feeling this every day in math class, you may start to feel like, oh, yeah, this subject doesn't belong to me. And you know how we are, people of color. We need to feel like we are in that community, right? Zaretta Hammond talks about us being a collectivist group of people. We need to feel like we are part of that community. If we are not a part of this community, like if you don't show us that we need what you're trying to give us, we either turn away, we check out, or we turn your whole classroom upside down because you are not seeing us. So.
Yeah. You just took me down like my literally life seeing us not represented. And I spoke to this earlier, but I remember when I left one school that was pretty much 50% Black, 50% white, and I went into a majority white space where it was 97% white students there. And I was the only Black male teacher, only Black teacher in general, in the entire high school. I did a year and a half of high school. And I just was so uncomfortable. And it wasn't because the people didn't look like me. It was because what started resonating or coming up to the surface was this idea that I'm less than them because they don't look like me. And I got into this school because of how I interviewed and what I brought in as far as effectiveness, as far as teaching. And so this school in Pennsylvania, they literally getting a job there is hard. Like the teaching, it's different in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. They take care of their teachers. It's a union and everything like that. So I was the 40th person to apply for this job. And though they were looking for diversity, they wanted somebody that could help the culture and move the needle and support their kids. And so though I got in because I was a great teacher, I literally was there in whole imposter syndrome because mm-hmm. of this narrative mm-hmm. that you receive about you because you don't see yourself being right. capable because you don't necessarily, like you said, see yourself in the curriculum, see yourself in the classroom. You go into a space and you never see. So this can't be for us.
Right.
Because we're not here.
Right. And the teacher doesn't look like me either.
Yeah.
And that 2%.
Yeah.
Or less than at this point. It, like I said, it's cyclical.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much. And that's why we fight the way we fight. That's why we say the things that we say. That's why we lift up what we lift up, because there are some experiences that you have to live. Now, we can all empathize. And I'm not saying people people that are not of color can't empathize with what we're saying or see the reality or the truth of it. But to understand and live it is different. And you have to, like we say, honor and speak your truth in mercy and also receive it in mercy, you know, in that moment. So I thank you for speaking your truth with mercy and in mercy. And I feel that even though you are hitting you're hitting it where it needs to be hit today. But there's such a grace and mercy about the way you're speaking it. And so I want to talk about you talked about math. We've been talking about math. Why in our culture is mastering math so important? I think you've already talked about it. I don't know. I just want to squeeze it even the more. Why is mastering math so important?
Okay, so I'll start broad and then kind of, I guess, maybe funnel down. Mm-hmm. It's important for our culture because we're so dynamic and we have so much to contribute to our society. Mm. And we know that because of the same 17 people we study in Black History Month every year. I'm just using that as an example because that was then, this is now. We have access to technology in a way that we've never had before. We have access to the internet and to other people as a result of the internet. We have opportunities to be right in our backyard and study with a professor on the other side of the country, other side of the world. We have the ability to develop our dynamic nature in a way that those 17 folks, as wonderful and as powerful as they were, and as important as their trailblazing was, they didn't have. So we have this ability, access now to potentially impact our country in a way that is currently causing us to live in a space of less than, mm-hmm. because we're not given the opportunities to add to this corporation, to add to how things are being produced and provided throughout the country. So that's what I mean when I said I was going to start kind of broad, like, because we don't have regular and consistent access to these rooms and these spaces, the world is missing out. The world is missing out. So then to go down just a little bit back to on a local level, same reasons, but in terms of schools in our and the ability for schools to help us grow on that in that community and have that community impact that we have naturally. We are naturally tribal people, right? Yeah. We want to help our community on a local level, on the school. The school is the opportunity creator and the maker, right? We have a chance in schools, if we are given access to mathematics properly, to positively impact our locales. As long as our educators, our teachers see that we are worthy.
Wow.
And then, like you said, I talked earlier about having access to different types of classes in high school.
Yeah.
Imagine if you are a math student, but you've never had a teacher of color. Mm. You're not really sure if math is for you. And then all of a sudden you don't take the right track or you don't make the right choices before you, as you're moving through math in high school. When you get out of school, what are you going to do? What is your plan? You're missing out on potentially being an investment banker. Mm. You're missing out on an opportunity to start your own company.
Yeah.
But you're not, if you don't have someone who sees that in you and helps cultivate that in you, in your community, someone in your community, if they don't see that in you, then you're missing out. And then if you're missing out, it impacts all of us. Then we're all missing out.
Wow. I love the way you phrase that. It's beyond anything I've heard when I've asked that question. And what I take away from what you just said is the mastery of mathematics. First of all, you don't get to show up and you don't get to participate in accessing this amazing content, this subject that, like you said, where my paper at, that helps develops our humanity. Right. And when we are not in these spaces where we're getting access, the world is missing out on us.
Yes.
Like you're missing out on the brilliance that we have because mm-hmm. you're trying to many times stay and keep your same company.
Yes.
And keep your same surroundings. And mm-hmm. you don't want to be pushed out of your comfort zone. I love the fact that it's so powerful to me because when you don't allow me to grow, you miss out on growth yourself.
You miss out.
Oh,
you miss out.
That's so good. I feel like I just need to just ask you for your Cash App and just send you like an offering today. This thing. Okay. So I know that you do and you develop professional development and you help teachers facilitate professional development as mm-hmm. it relates to equity in mathematics and what good mathematics that looks like. My question to you is, I'm trying to phrase two questions. What advice do you give teachers as it relates to facilitating teaching and mathematics? And no, I'll just leave it at that. I was going to go somewhere else.
So facilitating learning in the math classroom?
Yes, facilitating learning. Yep.
Okay. Well, I tell them, I think about this first. Shed your ego. Right? Again, in thinking about the elitism that is connected to mathematics, right? You have to, in order to make the shift from teaching mathematics to facilitating the learning of mathematics, you have to shift and shed your ego. You have to be okay with not being the only vessel of information in the room.
Adrian, that's a whole hashtag right now. Like, shed
your ego. Yeah. You have to think about letting that go and being okay with being a part of the learning that's taking place, right? We can't ask students to engage in collaborative learning if we don't walk the walk. So that's one of the things that needs to happen in order for teachers to make that shift to facilitation of learning. Another one is in their planning, they need to think about how to, instead of impart information, how to pose that same bit of information in the form of questions. Mm. Questions are super, super powerful. Marion Small does a really wonderful job in her text around developing open-ended questions. She was actually the first person that came across years ago when I made my shift from ELA to mathematics, because I wanted to figure out how to get more voices in the space in the classroom. And open-ended questions is a strategy that definitely creates that mathematical discourse that the standards call for, that we really want to have in class, because everybody benefits from that. Black, white, everybody benefits from rich mathematical discourse. So rather than figure out how you're going to teach this procedure or these procedures over the course of this lesson, think about ways for students to explore the concept in a way that they are able to come to some understanding and glean some information themselves. Mm-hmm. And questions, again, are a great tool for teachers to use. And it's an easy flip of the script when planning their lessons. So you got shedding your ego, using questions to cultivate the mathematical discourse, and then finally get out of the way. Get out
of the way.
Mm-hmm. You can observe, take notes, but don't dive in and save your students when they're debating, when they're questioning, when they're wondering. Give them those times that are that chance to collaborate and sense make with each other's ideas.
Yeah.
And I know parents that haven't had that experience push back and say, oh, well, I want my child to learn from you. He's not going to learn what he needs to know from his friend. Relax. If the teacher is in charge and creates a lesson that allows for that development of the conceptual understanding to occur through those questions, through the type of tasks that are selected, it will happen. As the educator, step out of the way, take your notes, go in when you need to clarify what's happening.
Yeah.
But then step right back out. Maybe leave a question with them and then step back out. That was one of the things I had to continue to encourage my co-teacher when we were detracking and the students were detracking pre-algebra and the boys were working in groups of three. They're working in triads. I would often have to look across the room at my co-teacher when I saw her swooping down and for the save.
Right, right.
Yes. Because I needed her to start to get comfortable with letting the boys struggle, letting them think through these ideas on their own, make those connections and those synapses in their brain stronger from that discourse.
Yeah.
Her swooping down and saying, oh, it's 7A.
Right.
And then, because once that happens, the thinking stops.
Stops. Over.
It's over. It stops. Yep. So, yeah, shed the ego. Plan with questions in mind and the answers, but questions certainly, and get out of the way.
Get out of the way.
Yeah.
Adrienne, this is my last question, and I feel like I've gathered it, but I just want to hear it one more time. What is your personal mission in advancing the mathematics for all of our students? What's your personal mission?
I really aim to educate and learn from as many math educators as possible. That it sounds really simple, but it is the truth. When I'm in a space where I'm surrounded by mathers like yourself who teach high school, I am an open vessel and eager to listen and learn and try to connect what I know with what you are dealing with students on a regular basis or were in your case.
Yeah.
when I'm in a space with teachers who are experiencing or who carry trauma with them, mm-hmm. I try to encourage them to be their own problem solvers. And again, speak to the multiple opportunities that they have to actually kill some of that trauma by taking a virtual professional development lesson. If you know you don't feel comfortable teaching division of fractions, you can actually now in 2023 take a couple courses, some of which are free, in the comfort of your own home, and go back into your classroom and be a boss.
Yeah.
But you have to care enough about yourself first and about the needs of your students. So yeah, I really, my ultimate goal in all of this is to educate as many math educators as possible and learn as much as I can from them as well.
I don't know what I was about to say, but, I mean, it's amazing because I feel like you project that so much so that I've just been sitting here learning from you. Literally.
Hi from you too.
Learning from you. And if one of the things that I'll just be vulnerable and say, that whole shed your ego thing, I needed an ego to shed. And mm-hmm. I didn't become good at shedding it only in probably in the past 3 to 4 years. Mm-hmm. Where I look back and I'm just like, gosh, I did so many things wrong. Mm-hmm. Oh, I did. Oh, and my perspective on math and what it looked like. And though I've been, you know, in the work trying to lift up everybody by lifting up the brilliance of Black boys. But like you said, Maya Angelou says, when you know better, you do better. And I had the joint chance to do better, because one thing you said, because when your heart is right.
Yeah.
And shed that thing and let it go, because who's it about? It's about these kids. Yes. And I want to be better for them because mm-hmm. I want them to be their best. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Adrian, I have thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with you today concerning is math a racist subject. Again, Adrian, you said it is not, but the way we give access is what causes the racism to perpetuate in our society. Y'all, this has been episode 5 with Is Math a Racist Subject, brought to you all by Miss Adrian Baytops Paul and her brilliance. I appreciate you all joining in and leaning in into this lesson. This is James O'Neill with another episode of Mastery for All. Have an amazing day, everybody. Man, oh man, I hope, listen, you got everything you needed from this episode. And I also hope that you got some clarity as far as is math a racist subject and how we can do better with the teaching of mathematics. As you already know, I'm a speaker, coach, consultant, and PD/workshop provider. I would love to partner with you and your school, your district, or maybe even your organization as it relates to supporting the Mastery of Mathematics for all of our students. Feel free to reach out to me through email at info@MrJamesO'Neill.com, or check out other resources at my website at MrJamesO'Neill.com. Follow me on Instagram or Facebook at Mr.JamesO'Neill, or LinkedIn and Twitter at MrJamesO'Neill without any dot. Listen, I am super excited that you decided to join me. Today. Have an amazing day.